Good afternoon and welcome to State of the News. I'm Gabe Bullard. For a look at Metro News, I'm joined by our WFPL News team, Rick Howlett, Philip Bailey, Erica Peterson, and Devin Katayama. We will start right away with the biggest news coming out, and that is some shakeups in the Metropolitan Sewer District. Erica, you were just down where the mayor was talking about this. Start us from the beginning with this audit.
Okay, well, there was an audit released today by Crit Llewellyn in the state auditor. And pretty much Mayor Fisher asked Llewellyn to look into the Metropolitan Sewer District and some of its practices way back in June. And that audit was released today, and it found some pretty serious problems in the district.
Like what?
Well, there are a bunch of things. One thing is they have basically had a contract, or not a contract, but they've had an agreement with a legal firm to provide services for about 27 years. And they haven't been working with a contract for the past several years. This isn't something that's been competitively bid like their professional services are supposed to be. So there are some questions about whether that was appropriate and whether that could be, influencing the board members in some inappropriate ways.
So they kept the same legal team, but they weren't bidding out for that service. So
yeah.
They weren't looking for possibly a lower cost option, a different option for a number of years.
Exactly. There's some other issues with very large bonuses, raises, generous deferred compensation packages, which the auditor found wasn't really appropriate for a state agency that is, you know, people have to pay rates to this agency. It shouldn't be using money like that. There were a couple of instances where they found money wasn't being properly documented, where purchasing card requirements weren't sufficient to make sure the money was all going to the right place, and where there was some money that had possibly been misused. There were some expenditures for parties that were a little bit high. They stressed it wasn't anything. They hadn't found anyone embezzling money or anything serious like that. Just some policies that perhaps could be put in place to make sure all the money is being documented correctly.
And what has been the reaction to this so far? The mayor spoke about an hour ago about this, made some pretty significant announcements.
Yeah, he did. And I think we have a clip from the mayor at his press conference.
There's been way too many people being way too cozy for way too long. And when you start reading finding number one, number two, number three, number four, you know, it goes on down the list, you say, you know, clearly we have got a culture problem that needs to be addressed.
And so that was Mayor Greg Fisher about an hour ago. And he was very disturbed by what the audit found. And he started out by making some really big changes and essentially clearing the slate of a lot of MSD's top positions. He announced that the executive director, Bud Shardine, who has been there for 28 years, and he praised his work there and said that Mr. Shardine has decided he will retire this spring, which was about a year earlier than he had originally intended to do. And Greg Heitzman from the Louisville Water Company will step into that role for an interim and kind of oversee the transition. But Bud Shardine will be there until spring, so he'll kind of, you know, have a role with that as well.
And this, we're talking about the leadership changes, this audit of the Metro Sewer District here on State of the News. 502-814-8255 is the number to call. If you'd like to discuss this on the air, you can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're WFPL News, or you can send an email to news@WFPL.org. What are some of the other changes, Erica, that are happening with MSD now as a result of this?
Well, three of the board members, and these are the three. There's an eight-member board. There's one spot empty, and four of the board members have been recently appointed by Mayor Fisher. So it's pretty much the three board members who have been there for the longest have announced that they will be leaving their roles in that. And that includes the board's chairman, Arnold Celentano. And Mayor Fisher stressed that, he doesn't think any of these people necessarily have a hand in some of these problems, but he just thinks that we need a culture change at the MSD. And one of the ways to do that is by putting some new people in who can attack the problems from new ways.
And what else will be happening as this is going on when Mr. Heitzman takes over? Has he announced anything?
No, they're going to be looking into a number of things. One of the things I thought that was interesting from the press conference is that Mr. Heitzman is obviously the head of the water company, which is also in kind of a weird role, just like MSD, where people pay rates to them, but they aren't, they aren't quite a metro government agency, really.
Right.
Yeah. So Mayor Fisher said he was going to be looking for some ways where maybe there could be some overlap, some collaborations between the two entities. He said, after all, they're both working, you know, below the streets. They're both and there possibly could be some cost savings and ways they could he didn't say merge, but, you know, work together.
That would require some change to state law, though, because while these aren't city agencies, these quasi-governmental agencies like this, they are governed by some of the state statutes.
Exactly. And he said that was kind of the most extreme option, is seeking a change to state law, but he wouldn't rule it out.
This reaction to the audit, we're still in Mayor Fisher's first year. Philip, I was wondering what your thoughts might be on this. We did see some audits under the previous administration, and what are your thoughts on how they compare?
Well, if we look, I guess, back at Crit Llewellyn's audits over the years, particularly under former Mayor Jerry Abramson, we see that there's a pattern of criticism of how Metro government and certain parts of it are run. I think that the MSD announcement, as Erica pointed out, will have large political ramifications in the sense that, you know, Mr. Sheridan is someone who's been here for at least 3 decades. I believe was the 4th highest paid official here in Louisville, Jefferson County. So you have a situation now where Fisher has fulfilled, and I think we'll brag about this for a number of years, probably up until his reelection, the fact that he did get the ball rolling on cleaning house at MSD, an agency in which there had been a number of criticisms and people had been nipping at it for a number of years. And now you see a complete culture change and a complete staff change at that agency, not only just with the executive director, but with the board as well.
And this comes at a time when there had been a number of controversies with MSD in the past few months, a number of reports revealing some questionable practices at MSD before this audit.
Yeah, and one of them was in regards to MSD's chief legal counsel, Larry Zilke, raising questions about why it was a no-bid contract. They were paying him and his firm a lot of money to represent the MSD and be their legal counsel. And the MSD at the time kind of used the excuse. They said, well, you know, he's been here for a long time and he understands all the nuances. And legal counsel is something where you can't really, you know, cycle someone in and out every year because you have to really get to know them. But this audit said that, you know, pretty much that wasn't appropriate.
And I think you see what the situation that has changed in the Fisher administration is that while Abramson had maybe a more laissez-faire attitude towards that agency, Fisher, I think, has clearly said and then made it clear that Metro government does control and will assert itself more so over MSD than in previous years. Whoever the new permanent executive director is, whoever future board members are, I think this is the day that actually MSD became more under control of Metro government.
And we do have, there was notice sent out that the board will be meeting. The MSD board is having a special meeting on Monday, presumably to deal with some of these issues, changes in leadership and all of that. And Philip, you say this could be seen as something of a victory or a high point for Mayor Fisher and his leadership, at least. But we'd also heard that there are some questions about the administration this week, something that you'd uncovered, some concerns among the Metro Council over an advisor that the mayor has.
Yes, earlier this year, caucus leaders, both Democrat and Republican caucus leaders, sent a memorandum to the mayor's office questioning the role of a high-profile contributor, Tommy Elliott, who is the senior vice president at Old National Bank. He's also a board member for the Kentucky Retirement Systems in the state. He was appointed by Governor Beshear. Mr. Elliott is a friend of the mayor's. He also was a contributor. He gave about $2,000 to Fisher's election campaign last year, $1,000 in the primary, and another $1,000 in the general election. He also served as co-chair of the mayor's inauguration committee. And it was, for council members, there was the understanding that unofficially, Elliott was the one who was picking or at least identifying nominees that the mayor appointed to different boards and commissions. Both Councilman Ken Fleming and Councilwoman Madonna Flood asked for Mr. Elliott to come before the Contracts and Appointments Committee in June. Councilman Fleming says the administration never responded. Chris Pointer, a spokesman for Mayor Fisher, says the administration did informally respond to their request. Councilwoman Flood said that she was satisfied with the administration's response. But when I talked to Councilman Fleming, he was suggesting that perhaps Mr. Elliott needs to testify before the Government Accountability Committee, in large part because of Mr. Elliott's role in a recent controversy involving the mayor using inauguration funds, money that was raised for that celebration, has been funneled to his campaign to repay his campaign debt.
Right. We saw that a few donors, Bruce Lunsford, who the mayor had previously run against in the Democratic Senate primary in 2008, who had donated to the inauguration, was requesting the money back because it had gone to the pay off this campaign debt?
Yeah, Mr. Lunsford and the businessman Ed Hart, who was involved with trying to reopen Kentucky Kingdom, both of those businessmen said they were very displeased with the idea that funds that they thought were going towards the inauguration part of that was being funneled towards repaying the mayor's campaign debt. People may remember back during the mayoral race, both during the primary and general election, Mayor Fisher was one of the more wealthy members, wealthy candidates running for office. There are other candidates who had attained debt as well. What makes the situation a little raises eyebrows is the fact that Mayor Fisher has continued to raise funds and seek contributions while in office to pay off that debt. It was also revealed that he attended a fundraiser in Lexington that was at the home of a lobbyist for Insight Communications. Obviously, people know that Insight is currently in negotiations for its franchise agreement with the city. So that has raised some eyebrows for folks. And the council, at least Councilman Fleming indicates that council members are more renewed by this interest, considering Mr. Elliott's role in that. Elliott was the one who had sent emails requesting the people fill out their checks to the Fisher campaign as opposed to the inauguration committee in order to better, I guess, funnel those funds to pay off the mayor's personal debt to his own campaign.
And what has the administration said to you when you're asking these questions about Mr. Elliott's role?
Well, you know, Chris Pointer made it clear that, you know, Mr. Elliott is a citizen volunteer, that he helped them identify and find a broad range of diverse candidates, that he no longer serves in that role, that it was really in the early beginnings of the administration that he did it on a volunteer basis. He wasn't paid. Mayor Fisher has indicated in other media outlets that Mr. Elliott is an advisor or has been an advisor to him on a number of issues, including the Kentucky Kingdom deal, which raises the question of a conflict of interest, considering he was also obtaining funds from Mr. Hart at the time. So these questions keep coming up, but as far as the appointment process is concerned, you know, Mr. Pointer said that, you know, the mayor's role with Mr. Elliott in that aspect wasn't really damaged, that he just identified candidates that the mayor eventually appointed who were qualified, who were racially, politically, and as far as what district they came from, very diverse.
All right, and this is something we'll make sure to keep following and have the latest on. And Devin and Rick, I want to turn to both of you. All three of us at some point, it seems, in the last week have been on this carousel of covering the hospital merger with University of Louisville Hospital, Jewish and St. Mary's Health System, and Catholic Health Initiatives. A lot of the controversy around this is over how care might change at University of Louisville Hospital once it merges with this division of Catholic Health Initiatives, what role religious doctrine might play, and all of that. And a lot of the concern is because these questions haven't been answered, this information isn't out there. And Rick, you'd covered the release of some of that information and even lawsuits over that information.
Right. The county attorney, Michael Connell, actually filed two lawsuits. He filed one against the company that runs University of Louisville Hospital, and then later the University of Louisville, because he says he submitted an open records request for pertinent financial and other strategic information related to the merger, and he didn't get what he wanted. U of L said it's proprietary. It's covered by attorney-client privilege, otherwise protected under the open records law. On the second suit, a hearing was scheduled for next week before Circuit Judge Irv Mays. However, earlier this week, an agreement was reached between O'Connell and U of L, under which U of L would release most of the records and enough of the records to satisfy O'Connell, and he says he won't pursue it more.
All right, and some of those records are online right now.
Yes.
The Mike O'Connell has posted a few of them. The merging partners themselves have posted a few of them. We'll add a link to the show to this on our website, WFPL.org, when we post this audio. And later in the week, or earlier this week, actually, but after the documents had after this agreement was reached, this group, Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, sent out a statement essentially saying that they were concerned that this was going to end up violating the separation of church and state, that there was going to create an unnecessary entanglement or an excessive entanglement of religion with a public body. The partners dispute this, the hospitals do. They say University of Louisville Hospital isn't public, as we had just heard, and then also that it wouldn't create this entanglement. So they're asking the governor not to approve this merger. The governor and the archbishop still have to sign off on it, and there's no real timeline for that at this point. But Devin, you covered a meeting where this whole thing was discussed at the Louisville Forum.
Yeah, the Louisville Forum, it was basically another one of these discussions where the public is invited to ask questions about the merger. There's still so many unanswered questions regarding what exactly is going to happen once these entities merge. And they tried to get a little sense of what some of those ideas were. For example, they took some information they got on WFPL when we had some representatives from the hospital merger here regarding indigent care, when one of the answers seemed to kind of scoot around the question of how much of the $320 million that CHI is infusing into the hospitals will be paid for indigent care. Now, they said $200 million of those dollars will be spent on basically programs and expanding services. And they said it was very hard to quantify exactly how much will be spent on indigent care. Now, the opposition panel brought some interesting data. They brought some facts regarding Medicare, like Medicare statistics showing which hospitals are disproportionately representing indigent care. And they found that University of Louisville and Jewish and St. Mary's actually provided a decent amount of indigent care with a list of, I think, 3,000 there in the upper like 400s or so towards the top. The other side, not so much. They were towards the bottom. So there were some facts that the opposition brought to try to draw out some answers from the merging entities, but it was very difficult throughout the whole process.
And what about these ethical and religious directives that have been discussed? What was said at the forum about that?
They continue to say that the entities, University of Louisville and Jewish, will remain their own kind of services. They won't be totally absorbed by CHI. The opposition tried to go to directives such as the end-of-life care wills, living wills, and CHI Dan Varga said that's part of the care that they provided at CHI hospitals is honoring those directives of end-of-life.
And one thing that is in these documents that have been released is at least what looks to be part of this list of procedures that will be changed, these tubal ligations that are being moved, certain differences with contraception. Contraception won't be distributed within the hospitals. You could still get a prescription there. They just won't be able to fill it. These are all things that are in these documents that we'll make sure to highlight later in our stories about this as well. Another thing that had happened with this, going back to this indigent care case, is the Metro Council Budget Committee. There were four Democrats led by Tina Ward Pugh who had withheld some of the city's payments. The hospital gets about $9.6 million a year for indigent care from the city, and it gives back about $2.6 million. But these four council members had withheld a payment because of a lot of these concerns. Mm-hmm. They said these questions hadn't been answered. And yesterday, the council overruled that tabling of it, and they're going to continue the money till March 15th, would the partners have to answer more questions. But in general, what is their response to a lot of the questions and criticisms that are flung at them?
If you ask anybody on the merger side, they say that this is a business transaction, that this really, that's why the documents aren't being shown. And in fact, it got pretty heated at some points when they were discussing why these documents weren't being released to the public.
Why would we not release the information? Because we have competitors that are hyper competitive. We do not want to give our competitors what our plans are until we absolutely have to.
I have to respond to that too.
We're going to move on to a question. No, we're going to move on.
No antitrust lawyer would object to university hospitals sharing the extent to which they're going to abide by the
Wait. Peter, we have rules for antitrust that we can't share information.
No merger document is going to have a business plan set out in it. And if it did, why didn't you just redact that and give us what we wanted to see?
And that's a lot of the arguments that you've been seeing back and forth with the county attorney, with the public, is these documents hold the answers. And so something that David Laird was saying with Jewish St. Mary's Health System was that don't make up arguments with facts that you don't have. And they're saying that's exactly our point. We don't have the facts to make up any kind of argument whatsoever. So they're using what they do know, which are Catholic health initiatives and the past history of the Catholic health initiatives in CHI.
All right. And this is something we'll make sure to keep following as more events happen. As we had said at the open to the show as well, that the partners are ready to merge at any time at this point, correct?
Yeah. Dan Varga said as soon as the governor takes a look and approves the merger, they're ready to go.
And also on the topic of religion, Rick, some sad news in the Archdiocese this week.
Yeah, the passing of former Archbishop Thomas Kelly led the Archdiocese of Louisville, which represents about 200,000 Catholics in the Louisville area and around Kentucky, passed away at the age of 80 this week. Unfortunately, his tenure is a quarter century in leading the church here in Louisville, going to be overshadowed a little, I think, by the child sex abuse scandal that erupted back in 2002. We had about 250 people file lawsuits claiming they were sexually abused by clergy, dating some of them dating back to the 30s and 40s, but a lot occurring in the 60s, 70s, and some in the 80s. Father Kelly came under some fire for kind of shuffling some of these priests around instead of having them removed from ministry. There was eventually a settlement of about $25 million with the victims of the sex abuse. And Archbishop Kelly talked about it in an address to the Rotary Club in 2003.
The victims are our number one priority. They are first in my consciousness, and they must be first in the heart of the church. Many of them have been seriously damaged in a way that is very difficult for us to understand. I will meet one-on-one with every victim of abuse who desires such a meeting. I will ask them to forgive me and the church for any of our failings.
And he did meet with some of those victims, and some new policies have been put in place in the Catholic Church, not only here but around the world, because the scandal, you know, erupted elsewhere as well. Other accomplishments during his tenure: the renovation of the Cathedral of the Assumption. Among them, he also oversaw some of the consolidation of parishes around Louisville and around the state as people moved to the suburbs, and he oversaw that. His funeral will be held at 2:00 on Tuesday at the Cathedral of the Assumption. We have complete arrangements at our website, wfpl.org.
All right. Thanks a lot for that, Rick. And Philip, want to turn to you real quick for some election news. First of all, Congressman Jeff Davis of Kentucky's 4th District is not running again.
Yes, Congressman Davis, who was first elected to Congress in 2004, he will not seek re-election. He's the first House Republican to actually announce his retirement of a class that will not be returning for the 113th Congress. His explanation, rather simply, is that he just wants to spend more time and devote more time to his family. So he's going to forego re-election in 2002. Already, the jockeying for that fourth congressional seat is beginning, particularly amongst Republicans. It's a, you know, a Republican favored district. So many people praise Congressman Davis's conservative record. Earlier in the year, it was interesting that he got into a little bit of a joust with the Heritage Foundation over that because they gave a scorecard saying that he wasn't as conservative as people had thought. But you know, I think Congressman Davis, who had earlier this year introduced the RAINS Act, which passed the House, I think that his legacy ultimately would be one of a stalwart conservative, both fiscally and socially. But it would be interesting to see in the next few weeks how people jockey for that position or that seat, particularly as that district is being redrawn by the General Assembly in Frankfort.
And that's something we'll make sure to follow. And even in the General Assembly here, there's a new candidate for state Senate.
Yes, Sean Riley, who's running for retiring State Senator Tim Shaughnessy's seat here in Louisville. Mr. Riley is, as most people may know now, the co-founder of the Say No to Bridge Tolls group, which opposes a tolling on the current infrastructure to pay for the Ohio River Bridges project. Mr. Riley is pretty well known in Democratic circles, a progressive Democrat, someone who is not afraid as far as articulating those positions. He was very involved in the anti-Iraq war movement from really the war's inception. So he's someone who's going to be, I think, gaining a lot of attention because he's young. He's someone who's very outspoken about his beliefs. And as a result of the Bridges Project issue, he's someone who's been very prominent in the local media really for the past year and a half, 2 years.
All right. Thanks a lot for that. And Devin, I want to turn to you. Kentucky has begun to release some of these child abuse records over some recent cases.
Yeah, they've released over 80 cases. And this is from between 2009 and 2010, child abuse records of fatalities or near fatalities. This was on court order, but they redacted a lot of the information, a lot of defining information such as victims' names or people involved even, some age identifiers, so they might not even know how old this person is, the cause of death in some cases. The Courier Journal was one of two news organizations that filed suit to get these records. It sounds like they're going to be going back to court and try to hold these records in contempt for not really releasing the information that they really wanted to get. And so it's an issue that's been around for a while, but it's recently gained a lot of attention in the media just because of an incident recently where one caseworker kind of not ignored, but did not pursue an investigation which led to a child's death. And that kind of spawned a whole idea about transparency within the Cabinet for Health and Family Services. So actually Monday they're going to be meeting in a joint committee to discuss ideas of transparency in the Cabinet and what they might be doing going forward to kind of promote more openness in that Cabinet.
All right, and we'll make sure to follow up on that Monday after that hearing happens. And one quick note for the weekend, and we'll close out our Metro segment here. Erica, the Sandhill Crane Hunt, the long-announced controversial hunt, has drawn some mixed interest.
Well, it has. The hunt starts officially tomorrow, and it lasts for 30 days or until 400 birds are killed, whichever comes first. And they have had 332 people requesting permits. They had allotted 400 and kind of thought they'd be doing a lottery for those, but they didn't have enough interest. And what's really interesting is there's no way to gauge this, but I spoke to Ben Yandell, who has been leading up kind of the opposition to this hunt, and he said that he knew a number of people who were going to apply for permits, you know, but were against the hunt, were just trying to take those spots. And there's no way to measure how many actually did do that. But so some of the people who got the permits could not be planning on hunting them.
Interesting. And if this goes, this hunt is, it will last a month or until, is it 400 birds?
Yeah, 30 days or 400 birds, whichever comes first.
All right. Set your calendar for that, I suppose. I want to thank the WFPL News team here, Rick Howlett, Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama, and Philip Bailey. When we come back, we're going to look at status offenders, young people who end up in jail for truancy or non-criminal crimes. You're listening to State of the News. All right, and welcome back to State of the News. I'm Gabe Bullard. I'm joined by Debbie Yetter of the Courier-Journal. Debbie, you've written a series of articles this week on status offenders, and one of them starts off with this line. Here's your lead. Kentucky judges are jailing youths for truancy and other non-criminal offenses at one of the highest rates in the nation, sidestepping federal and state laws and ignoring the near-unanimous agreement of experts and advocates that it harms children. Could you describe this a little bit? First of all, why are they being jailed for non-criminal offenses?
Sure, Gabe. It's been a kind of a long-running problem in Kentucky, and it seems to be a case of the courts not really knowing what to do with these kids. These are situations where kids are runaway, where they skip school. Those are the majority of things that lead to what they call status offenses, an offense that wouldn't be a problem if you were an adult because you don't have to go to school and you know, you're not a runaway at that age. But as a sort of a lack of anything else to do, judges sometimes are jailing kids for contempt of court. Now, you technically can't jail a kid for a status offense since it's not actually a criminal violation. But if a judge, say, orders a child to quit running away or go to school and the child skips school or runs away, then the judge can find him in contempt of court. It's kind of a loophole in the law. And then they end up in juvenile jails, which doesn't seem to really be making anyone happy. The juvenile justice folks don't believe they belong there. Most advocates don't, but it's still happening.
And is this an effective way to fight truancy?
Apparently not. Kentucky continues to have a fairly high truancy rate. And most of the advocates I talk to and folks who deal with kids and judges, family court judges, say truancy generally is a symptom of broader problems within a family. It's poverty, it could be bullying, it could be mental health issues, severe abuse or neglect in the home, all these factors. And sometimes before a kid finally comes to the attention of the court, they may have missed 50 or 60 days in a school year, which is really kind of amazing. And at that point, if the courts are on it, they will kind of look into this and try to address the problems that are keeping the child from going to school.
Yeah. Is there anything being done to look at these problems? One person you write about, one of the children didn't want to go to school out of being bullied. And there are a number of concerns that students have that are making them miss this. Is there anything going on to treat those symptoms? Are those causes?
Again, you know, budgets are tight everywhere in counties and statewide for social services and community programs. And frequently what the judges tell me is the families need services. They may need mental health counseling. They need help with basics like food, clothing, shelter. Jefferson County alone has 10,000 kids who are considered homeless out of a population of about 100,000 school kids. So there are efforts to address it. I don't think there is any kind of major statewide initiative or anything system-wide to take on the problem.
Is there any difference in how this works geographically? Is Jefferson County any different than, say, any of the other more rural counties?
Yeah, and in our reporting this, it seemed, for one thing, Jefferson County, which has, I believe, 10 family court judges, by policy, even though law allows it, they do not typically jail status offenders. They try to find foster placements. They try to get, you know, the school involved with services to the family. They try to find an emergency shelter if necessary, but they don't detain them. Some judges around the state have varying attitudes about it, and it seems in districts without family courts, and not all of Kentucky has a family court system where the judges are more involved with the whole family, but if it's a district judge, you tend to see more of it in those counties, just anecdotally looking around, where out of lack of other options or understanding of what to do, they may just end up thinking they'll teach the child a lesson and detain them.
And what does this cost? Or, well, first of all, how long are some of these kids ending up in jail for?
Well, Kentucky Youth Advocates has done a lot of research on this issue. It's hard to tell just from the raw data, but their determination was that kids stay anywhere from an average of 5 to 6 days in a juvenile jail. And it's not cheap. It's much cheaper to house adults than kids. And I think the average cost per child per day is $210 currently.
And you're right that this ends up costing the state in the long run as well, not addressing these problems that lead to truancy.
Right. Educators are concerned about that because kids with chronic absenteeism and truancy problems tend to drop out or fare poorly in school. And that's not what they believe the workforce needs.
And is there some legislation out there to possibly make some changes to this?
Yes. A bill came up last session in January of 2011, but didn't get through the legislature that would really just promoted some kind of modest efforts to try to recognize and deal with the problem, promote awareness, get more information to judges, limit length of these court orders where kids can be found in contempt. Kelly Flood of Lexington, a representative, has proposed that legislation again for 2012, and it seems to have a little more interest this time.
Is this one of those things we see these issues a lot in the General Assembly? They'll come up one year, be largely ignored. They'll come up another year and get a little bit of attention. And then eventually, maybe 5 or 6 years after it's first introduced, there's action taken on it.
Yeah, sometimes it gets traction after two or three times. Some lawmakers have told me, don't expect it the first time, but sooner or later, they'll hope to get it through.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for being here. Debbie Yetter with the Courier-Journal has written a series of articles on status offenders, and we'll make sure to link to those on WFPL.org. And all this year, the commemoration of the 150th anniversary of the Civil War has been going on. It's in full swing across the country. And as WFPL's Rick Howlett reports, two exhibits are now open in Louisville that explore Kentucky's unique position as a border state in the Civil War.
Now, this is material from Isaac Craig. And he
at the Filson Historical Society, curator of Special Collections Jim Holmberg takes a visitor through the exhibit United We Stand, Divided We Fall. Kentucky began the war as officially neutral. It eventually became a Union state, but family loyalties and opinions on issues such as slavery could be deeply divided. Holmberg says one of the more high-profile divisions occurred within the family of former Kentucky Governor and U.S. Senator John Crittenden.
His sons actually split. One was a general in the Confederate Army, another was a general in the Union Army. So here's this kind of like the poster family for something like this that happens. But it did happen.
The Filson collection includes an 1861 letter Crittenden wrote to his son George, imploring him not to resign his Union military commission and join the Confederacy, as others had done. It was advice that George Crittenden would ignore. Both George and his Union general brother Thomas survived the war.
We have a long and sordid history in the Civil War. Actually,
Joan House says it was long established that her third great-grandfather, Benjamin House, and his brother John both served in the Union Army. But she kept hearing rumors about a third brother.
So I went back and looked at the records, and it seems that the youngest boy, Sam, signed up with Morgan's Cavalry in Lexington in 1861 and rode with him throughout the war.
House says no one really knows why Sam joined Morgan's Confederate Riders. While Civil War divisions have endured for generations in some families, Joan House says the surviving brothers put aside their differences and returned to their native Jessamine County to work the family's land. They also followed their mother's admonition not to discuss the Civil War in her home. The Filson Historical Society exhibit includes some pieces from its large collection of Civil War-era sheet music. This wistful ballad, Lorena, performed here by the late John Hartford, is about a broken engagement. Its story of longing became a favorite of soldiers on both sides.
All the years creep slowly by, Lorena. The snow is on the ground again.
Division, longing, and homesickness are addressed in another Louisville Civil War exhibit, My Brother, My Enemy, at the Fraser History Museum. Many of its artifacts are on loan from the descendants of William Albert Thormeyer and his son George, German immigrants who joined the Union Army but spent the war apart. George's great-great-grandson, Albert Thormeyer of Austin, Indiana, came into possession of the items, including wartime letters written in German, from an uncle.
So we decided that that would be the best place for him. Put him someplace where that everybody could enjoy them for some period of time.
Despite his family's rich history, Thormeyer says he's not a big Civil War buff. But that's not the case with Joan House, whom we met earlier. The Civil War is her vocation. She's the preservation coordinator for the Perryville Battlefield State Historic Site in Boyle County, Kentucky. Next October will mark the sesquicentennial of Kentucky's bloodiest battle. More than 1,400 men were killed at Perryville. Hundreds more would die from their battle injuries. On a windy fall morning, Joan House and the park staff were closing the Battlefield Museum for the season.
I don't think people really get what a loud, ugly, noisy, hateful place this was 150 years ago. And people come out and they see all the pretty trees and the flowers, and it's very peaceful, but I think the soldiers would be okay with that.
Rick Howlett, WFPL News.
And I'm here with Rick Howlett, who you just heard doing this piece. So, Rick, is there still a lot of interest outside of these exhibits just in general in Kentucky in the Civil War?
Oh, yeah, and especially now since it's the 150th anniversary. But there has been. I guess really the Ken Burns documentary kind of fueled the interest. But people are still just really fascinated by it, and I think they would enjoy both of these exhibits mentioned in the piece. The Filson exhibit, they've been collecting Civil War stuff since about 1884, so the stuff that's on display is really just the tip of the iceberg, but it's really fascinating, and it is free at the Filson Historical Society, and a wonderful exhibit over at the Fraser History Museum, the stuff donated by Albert Thormeyer's family, and also some artifacts from Mary Todd Lincoln's unfortunate post-presidency problems with a mental illness.
Yeah, some of that paperwork was believed lost or destroyed for a while,
right.
Correct? And then the Fraser was able to obtain it.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly some fascinating documents there. And one thing I think that might interest people a lot in the Civil War is that it happened right around where they live for a lot of people in the country. And the Battle of Perryville, how's that going to be commemorated?
That was the largest battle and the bloodiest battle in Kentucky, and one of the major battle of the whole Civil War, and it took place in October of 1862. So next year will be the sesquicentennial of that. There's going to be a big reenactment and lots of other activities surrounding that.
All right. Thank you very much, Rick, for being here. And when we come back, we're going to talk with two members of the LEO staff about the year's top losers. You're listening to State of the News. And welcome back to State of the News. I'm Gabe Bullard. I'm here with Sarah Kelly and Joe Sonka of LEO Weekly to talk about losers. The annual Loserville issue is out on newsstands right now. And the headline here, guys, is remembering a year that should have been better. 2011. Was 2011 a better year for compiling Loserville than maybe 2010 or what's been going on since 2008?
I have to say that there's always ample material to work with. So we haven't had a problem yet since we started this 4 years ago.
It was a question of who to cut. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I'd like to have been a fly on the wall in that editorial meeting and deciding who doesn't meet the criteria to be one of the losers of the year. So how do you end up deciding who makes the cut? I mean, does it have to be? There are a number of people in here, Councilwoman Judy Green, former Councilwoman Judy Green, the Sherman-Minton Bridge, Ken Ham, a number of names that are in the news already. Is that just where you start picking these names?
Yeah, we actually, in our respective offices, we have whiteboards where throughout the year, we'll actually start right now for next year's, we keep a running tally of people who basically screw up throughout the year, and we end up with a very lengthy list.
And one thing I've noticed, I was looking back at the past lists, every year you've done this, there's one name that's always there, and it's Senator Mitch McConnell has made every list.
Well, he's the pride of our state, the pride of our city, and he knows that some hostages are worth ransoming, as he told us this year.
Yeah, we actually came up with the idea because there are some repeat offenders that we might make that a recurring segment of this is the repeat offenders.
And were there any other repeat offenders on this list? There's certainly a number of names that pop up in the news quite a bit. I assume the gubernatorial race had a lot to do with some of the choices here.
Yes, there were plenty of losers to choose from on the statewide candidate list. I think Bill Johnson may have made his one and only appearance. I'm not sure if we'll be hearing from Mr. Johnson again.
And if you want, feel free to read from any of these. If you want to start choosing some of your favorites, were there any in particular that maybe you were thinking about cutting that, you know, you get into the meeting and you say, no, we have to keep that person on. You know, we have to put, say, Richie Farmer on. Is there much dispute around any of these names?
Well, I mean, you brought up Mitch McConnell, and there is the question of, you know, does it get to a point where it's overkill? But I think, you know, like I said before, there's plenty of new fodder each year.
Yeah, I had second thoughts about Perry Clark because I like Perry. But when you do what Perry did this year and talk about 9/11 truth and how Lyndon LaRouche is an American statesman, you kind of, you know, you have it coming.
Yeah, if you could describe a little bit more this situation, it was an odd set of circumstances or an odd series of developments around Perry Clark.
Yes, he said that Obama should be impeached, and then made the very unfortunate comparison to Hitler, and it kind of went downhill from there.
The comparison that's all too common online. This was in a letter he had written, right, to the Lyndon LaRouche PAC.
Yes, Lyndon LaRouche is one of the most notorious crackpot conspiracy theorists of the 20th century, and apparently he still has his followers. Perry Clark actually endorsed him for president in 2004, and that's a very unfortunate infatuation that he has with the person that thought that the Soviet Union invented AIDS, I could go on for for days about what Lyndon LaRouche believes.
And speaking of just politics in general and the election, you mentioned Bill Johnson made his appearance here. Richie Farmer made his appearance here. Also, Todd Peepool, who lost in the sense of not winning his election. What were some of the criteria that made you want to put Todd Peepool on the list?
Well, he had Obama Tourette's. He could not go 5 seconds without mentioning the name Obama. And one of his ads was very tasteful, had in blood-soaked letters that Barack Obama is destroying America, and then a baby crawling across the screen. So it was a very odd contrast of images there. And he was also had some very fine acting in his ads, you know, decking the crime tape and acting in scenes. So I actually probably enjoyed his ads more than any other.
And yeah, we saw both candidates for attorney general this year had shots of them on a crime scene.
I don't remember the Conway crime scene.
Jack Conway he was talking to it looked like one of the county sheriffs and kind of pointing and giving some directions, which was interesting.
I remember in one ad, he was just there was a mother sending her kid off to school, and he was just oddly standing in her front yard when that happened.
The duties of the attorney general, yes. You never know. And not that it's all just one side. It's not all candidates from one party or another. Also, Steve Beshear made the list despite winning the election by a significant margin. What earned him a spot?
And to them, I say, get off our backs. yeah, I mean, Steve Beshear basically ran with no real agenda. His agenda was he's not David Williams, and that was enough. And certainly the favorable treatment, which was an understatement to the coal industry over his past 4 years, certainly gave him a spot on that list, even though he won. But come on, who's going to lose to David Williams this year?
But like you said, his failure to show up and even, you know, bother to share an agenda was reason enough.
Yes.
When you make the list, obviously, you know, there's a lot of this that's in good fun, but how much of it is one of those things just to point out something that's inherently silly or inherently frustrating in news coverage in general or in events that are happening?
Sure. I mean, we do get some flack for this because people think we're being too snarky or being too negative, but really, it is as much fun as it is to compile and to make some jokes about this. These are all actual newsmakers. I mean, throughout the year, all of these issues, for the most part, have been, you know, covered because they're legitimately, you know, newsworthy. So it's not necessarily being negative. It's as I say, you know, in the intro, it's pointing out the flaws and urging people in this city and in the state to do better.
And seriously, if you can't make fun of Rand Paul, then what can you make fun of?
And I think Rand Paul was on last year's list, too, I believe. I'm not sure. I haven't memorized all of them every year. But not only are they newsmakers, but they're news reporters. There are a few media figures on here. Eric Flack stuck out, the Wave 3 troubleshooter.
Yes. Watch out. He could be surveilling you right now.
Yes. I actually, that's a guilty pleasure. I actually quite enjoy his segments. I'm not really laughing with him. I'm laughing at him mostly. But yes, there are lots of things to be afraid of, and he will be there with his camera.
Yes. I mean, part of the problem that we see with him is the alarmist nature of some of his reporting. And yes.
And so there is a hope here that possibly that somebody might see this and hopefully if they saw themselves listed would laugh along with it, but would also then possibly make some sort of adjustment to what they're doing if maybe you pointed out that way.
Absolutely. I mean, that's sort of a lofty goal, I suppose, but that would be great if this could affect some actual change.
It would be great if Rand Paul didn't blame a government bureaucrat for his plug toilet in a Senate hearing this year. I would feel like I'd done something.
That was one of the most popular YouTube clips, I think, for Kentucky politics was this testimony. So what's the response? Do you ever hear back from people that you'll list and make a joke about?
Oh, yes. We definitely, especially the first year, I think it sort of took people by surprise, particularly the name of the issue, Loserville. But I think as it's, you know, now in its fourth year, people are have come to expect it. And, you know, as I said before, we're taking people to task, but it's really no different than what we do week to week. It's just in a compiled list for your easy reading enjoyment.
And not just people, there are a number of inanimate objects, some that never existed at all. Museum Plaza stuck out.
Yes, the mega skyscraper that never came to be.
That could have been.
Yes.
Museum Plaza is on here. What else? 732 Social, the restaurant. A number actually reflecting the restaurant and bar scene in Louisville.
Yes.
And some of the changes of the year.
And I think that is something this year that obviously is different than in years past, in large part due to the economy. We've had numerous bars and restaurants close, and we pointed that out. We also listed local music lovers, and that was in response to Ear Ecstasy closing. So many people turned out and were heartbroken and upset with the closure of Ear Ecstasy, yet no one's really taken any of the blame for that.
And we also added our landlord, and we're still currently in the offices and haven't been evicted yet. So
thanks for bringing that up, Joe.
Yeah, you do mention Todd Blue is the landlord of the Leo building. You know, is that a concern that you have now? Is he
no.
worried that they might be, you know, are the locks being changed while you're out?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. But he's a businessman. I'm sure he takes it with a grain of salt. So we shall see. I'm sure he has a sense of humor.
In mentioning the local music lovers, that's the only one that, so far at least, that I had heard a complaint about. A few people have said, just in general, looking at it, that maybe someone, John Timmons, maybe someone else running the scene should have done it. There was a complaint that I had heard, at least from people, feeling like they were called losers for something they really couldn't control.
Right. There are many sides to this and many facets to this whole story, but could the business model have been changed? Yes. But at the same time, you know, people who complain about the music store closing hadn't been in a year or 2 years. So they weren't really showing up to spend their money.
And one of the inanimate objects on here that I think has gotten a really large amount of criticism this year, the mayor's Facebook and Twitter accounts as well. That's presumably the first time that a social media account has been listed as one of the top losers.
It is, and the description is short and sweet. We say it's boring and occasionally inaccurate.
I think that fits within the 140 character limit as well. And so one issue with Loserville, it comes up every year, and every year I've heard this from Philip Bailey when he was with Leo and now that he's with WFPL. He says he invented it.
He's creative, and he has got an interesting take on history, although he is a good reporter, solid. But I would say it was a collaborative effort. That's the best I can do.
And now we've heard both sides of the story. Is there any plan in the future possibly to pull a Time magazine and just put a mirror on the cover?
Well, actually, in years past, we have listed you, and people definitely took exception to that. So that was sort of our take on the Time Man of the Year.
All right. The Loserville issue is out right now on newsstands, Loserville issue of Leo. Thanks to Joe Sonka and Sarah Kelly for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Also, thanks to Debbie Yetter with the Courier-Journal and Rick Howlett, Erica Peterson, Philip Bailey, and Devin Katayama with WFPL. This is State of the News, and it's produced by our news staff. Our production team is led by Brad Yost, Laura Ellis, and Joe Durso. For more information, for full audio, for links to these stories that you heard, visit WFPL.org. This is State of the News. I'm Gabe Bullard.